Welcome. I'm Jessica Teigen, and this is the Evolving to Exceptional podcast, where we talk about reaching peak performance in our workplaces, homes, and communities so that we can live our best life possible, an exceptional life. I want to welcome back all of our listeners to this week's episode of Evolving to Exceptional. We have a really tremendous thought leader, individual who is focused in the space of organizational transformation, a leader and a person that has some personal experience and wisdom to share with us today. Lindsay Ruiz, thank you for joining us today so much. We're excited to hear from you. Lindsay has been a leader in organizational transformation and throughout her career. She's done PhD work in the space, and she's here to share with us some of what she's learned and some of what she's experienced. Lindsay, I want to give you a chance to give yourself a much better maybe background or give our audience a sense of who you are, why you do what you do, how you got to where you are, and what makes you super passionate about organizational transformation in particular.
Yeah, I'm super excited to be here with you, Jessica. And I hope that our conversation today really inspires a new paradigm for your listeners in terms of understanding organizations from the inside out. I'm Venezuelan, so you're going to hear an accent from me all throughout our conversation. I was born and raised in South America. I came to the United States in 2001, so I've been here about 22 years altogether. At a personal level, super humbled to have the opportunity to have navigated my career in such a tremendous way, both in my home country and here in the United States. I have about 20 plus years of career trajectory. We're not going to get into the details of the timing here, but it's been a long journey. I started in marketing and advertising back in Venezuela. I am an early career woman that navigated the first few years in the world of creating advertising campaigns for big brands. I came to the United States. Like I mentioned, I took a little detour into healthcare operations for about 7 or 8 years. Coming into the U.S., launching we didn't use the word startup back in the day, but it was really a startup organization that expanded across the North Carolina area. And I came in to help that expansion, especially as the Hispanic community was a new audience for the services this organization provided. And through that journey, I came to a little bit of a ceiling in my career where, having been put in a position of managing people and managing operations at the same time, my self-awareness as a leader was not necessarily where it needed to be. And I realized I needed to become more deliberate. And that's what brought me to further education in the space of organizational transformation, organization development, change management. I pursued a master's degree in organization development, which is what opened the doors for me to work in big, large organizations driving transformation programs. And that's what I've been doing for the past 13 or 14 years. Mm-hmm. And more recently, I also navigated my academic journey to finish my doctorate degree in organization development and change, given me the opportunity to deepen research in areas that I'm very concerned about, both from personal experience and for what I have learned in my work in organizations, to look at them systemically and understanding different dysfunctions, different things that need to change in order for change to be meaningful and sustainable. And that's what brought me where we are today in the conversation.
So let's dive right into that, because I'm super curious about what your research has shown. There are so many challenges, I think, today in terms of the organization and the workplace and how people are working and how different organizations are navigating the changing landscape in terms of both COVID from the last few years, but also huge advances in technology with AI entering the workplace and just the digital transformation in general. So I'm curious, can you tell us a little bit about your research, what you did, why you did it, and a little bit about what you found?
Sure. Straight out the gate, the research that I pursued, it's called A Hidden Virus, Looking for Evidence of Narcissistic Abuse in the Workplace. So it's very straightforward. I did choose a topic that could be considered unpopular. However, a lot of conversation going around the idea of narcissistic leaders and narcissistic organizations that I felt needed some more grounding. And I wanted to use my academic study to understand that at a deeper level. I took a phenomenology approach, which means I contacted various victims of this phenomenon and interviewed them and used their lived experiences as data to run the data through a framework of organizational diagnosis to understand where in the organization the phenomenon is localized and how it gets to spread across the various layers and infrastructures that an organization has. There are a couple of reasons why I pursued this. At a personal level, I myself have my good dose of exposure to the damages of working for either leaders that demonstrate narcissistic tendencies and or organizational cultures that have adopted a narcissistic personality, which we can talk about through this conversation, Jessica, a little bit more. And also, as an organizational transformation leader, there are always patterns that make an organization decide why to transform. And so for me, that was foundational to my professional development, of my professional understanding of how to be a better leader in the space, and also combine it with my personal concern for what is beyond the boundaries of an organization that transpires into potential abuse and potential impact on people's health. At a foundational level, some of the things that I used to pursue this research included the issues that we see day to day for organizations, like lack of reputation. We are seeing an increasing amount of employees that, if you go to Glassdoor, if you go to Fishbowl, like those type of websites that collect employee feedback, it continues to be increasingly non-positive, increasingly negative to what people understand as toxicity in the workplace. So for me, that was really a really important starting point, because toxicity can mean so many different things. And it was important for me to put it in the context of what's the pathology that's creating the toxicity and where it comes from. And also, we hear a lot as you get into organizations and diagnose what is changing, what needs to change and why. The patterns are always towards the decline in team morale, in productivity, mediocre culture and performance, individual morale and tied to self-worth in the workplace that causes people to either leave on their own or be affected by attrition by default. And unintended consequences that we always see in terms of those who are impacted, that start gives them a frame of reference for what not to look for in another organization. So in a way, you're carrying with you a little bit of trauma from experiences in the workplace that you get to bring to other jobs that you're looking for, that may be detrimental for somebody's career at some point.
So let's start with, there's a lot there that you just talked about. Mm-hmm. So let's break it down a little bit. I'm actually going to go with the last thing that you just said, and then we can go back to what, in terms of, I'm really curious about what it looks like in the culture itself. So in the organization, mm-hmm. the toxicity in the organization itself, or that narcissistic behavior. But I want to hit on what you just said about how being in that type of culture, organizational environment, carries with you when you move to your next workplace. I myself have been in challenging situations in the past, and I know it's taken me quite a bit to get over, to work through some of those traumas. And I'll say trauma with a little T rather than trauma with a big T, but it's still trauma mm-hmm. when you're going through such extreme stress and the challenges that come along with it. What have you seen, either in terms of your research or just the people that you've worked with, as the most common effect of that experience? What is it that people take with them, and how does it impact them in their next role?
There are a few things here. So the abuse that I research, which is a specific tie to narcissism, in itself carries a big connotation of complex trauma. A lot of people talk about it from a personal relationship standpoint, like when you are with your significant other, or maybe you're a part of a narcissistic family, but it's not different when you are dealing with this type of dynamics in the workplace. It happens in a spectrum. It happens covertly and is so subtle that by the time you realize you're a part of, or you're like embedded in this type of dynamics, you already affected at a physical level. There are real, true physical symptoms that you have to recover from if you're transitioning from an environment that enables this type of dynamics to another that hopefully is a little healthier. There is a transition path from a physical standpoint to recover from feeling on the edge for a long time. This could be anxiety, things around confusion, uncertainty, hypervigilance, for constantly being walking on eggshells, trying to protect yourself and trying to understand the dynamic and the fog that you are really a part of when you are in those type of relationships. You start to suffer as well from cognitive difficulties. These really affect your ability. Even if you're a rock star, you start to see yourself declining in your ability to stay focused and your ability to build boundaries for yourself and your ability to control intrusive thoughts that may or may not lead into negative self-talk. This also has an impact on behavioral issues, confusion, like I mentioned, inability to rest. You may find yourself at home ruminating. What's going on? Why is this happening? I don't understand the dynamic. I don't have the way to come back next day and continue to deal with this person or these people. Your pace of work and your pace of showing up in the workplace, especially if you're in a high visibility role, also begins to decline and it intensifies your ability to stay connected to what your role is there to do versus how that's affecting you at a personal behavioral level. And your social interactions may begin to change as well. You might become very isolated, which is a signature mark of being a part of these relationships, that you start to see yourself more and more alone in the process. And then there's an emotional impact too. This is a really unfortunate situation, but narcissistic abuse in the workplace is also a form of trauma. And I don't know, I'm not a clinician to categorize it as big trauma or small trauma, but what I know from my research and from the things that I have been able to dig deeper into is that the parallels of the experience at the emotional level are very similar. Fear, sense of guilt, constantly growing through a grieving process, denial, all the way up to the strongest parts of depression and intense anger and emotional shock. There are real effects that at a physical level, people really have to navigate and heal from. And there is the institutionalized level response, which is typically very deficient, that on top of your personal experience going through it, should you decide to bring it up, should you decide to seek help and support from the organization to help you address the issue, more likely than not, the institutional response is lacking as well, which adds another level of concern and difficulties for yourself as an individual, not only not having to deal with it directly, but also trying to understand why the organization is not helping you through the process, but adding more to it.
So it's super interesting, and that's really helpful to see how much of an impact the experience can mm-hmm. have and how lasting that can be. And I think one of the important things to point out for those that may be in the situation or maybe questioning if they're in the situation is that from a neurophysiological perspective, the experience that you're having and the impact that it's having on your body or the long-term implications of that experience are not conscious choices. Mm-hmm. It's going to affect your neurophysiology. It's going to affect your body, your nervous system. in a way that is not, there's nothing you can do to stop it. It's not mm-hmm. like you can necessarily put up a barrier and say, I'm not going to be affected by this, because you're simply by being in that experience, your body's going to be impacted by it. Your nervous system's going to be triggered. There's going to be lasting implications and residue from those experiences. So let's talk about what those experiences look like. So let's talk about what does it look like to maybe one, work for a narcissistic leader? You hinted at that there's quite a bit of conversation and talk about that. But then you also talked about having the kind of the narcissistic traits embedded in the culture or an environment like that. What does that mean? What does that look like?
Sure. We can talk about it in both contexts. I want to add something to what you just clarified for your listeners in terms of the conscious choice or the non-conscious choice in this process. There is a, this is more common than not. Okay. These type of situations happen every day. You always come across, whether it's your boss, whether it's a friend, whether it's a neighbor, the way in which relating to narcissists and people with this kind of traits or pathology happen, it's an everyday thing. So it's very possible that once you are in the workplace and you come across this more delineated, right, context for this type of abuse to take place, you have already gone through something similar in other relationships in your life. And so the idea of this is not a conscious choice may resonate with me too, because it may also be that the experience is re-traumatizing. It may be that you're also having healed from other instances in the past where you have come across these type of people and instances, and now the pattern is resurfacing. And so all the fears and all the anxiety and the symptomatic things that happen in your body are just stored experiences that come out, right? And feel more and more intense over time, the more you come across these type of things.
It's a great point.
So it's important, because what happens sometimes is that we compartmentalize and we say the workplace is one thing and my marriage is another thing and my friendships are another thing. And the curious thing about this pattern is that it's a playbook. It's predictable. It's typically the same encounter through the same cycle of abuse with the same types of abuse embedded in the complexity of their relationship. And it doesn't change whether if you change the setting as to where it happens. If we think about that from that sort of standpoint, there are key, it's not like narcissistic abuse in the workplace happens in one way. What it means is that the pattern that narcissistic people use to prey on their targets could include various subtle ways of manipulating an individual or a group of individuals with behaviors that are typically hidden or normalized enough where the people being targeted not having the language to point it out or to address it can fall into very easily. These are things.
Yeah. What are some of those examples of what that looks like, or those subtle things that we may not be able to even identify ourselves?
Sure. There's a spectrum and there's a checklist, if you will, that we get to walk through very quickly. So one set of behaviors that we may be enduring and through these relationships include verbal abuse. These are typically talked about as belittling or bullying or being smeared and accused of something that we did not do. Shaming, those type of behaviors could be categorized as verbal abuse coming through these relationships. Another categorization could be everything that could be considered manipulation. Generally, this is the direct influence on somebody that pretty much makes that person behave in a way that benefits the manipulator. So they are these type of relationships that get entrenched when there's somebody acting as quote unquote the wolf in sheep's clothes. And then there are people buying into that charisma and ending up covering up or doing things that they're typically, that would typically be out of character for them. But because they're following these manipulative tactics, they get to perform in that capacity, typically handling things that could lack ethics and integrity and could lead into hostility and things of that nature. There is emotional blackmail that we can put in the spectrum. These typically include threats and warnings and intimidation, things of that nature, which is a form of manipulation that provokes the victim to be doubtful of themselves and feel an obligation to act in a manner that is not typical of their own integrity. This is a word that has gone mainstream and has people talk about it all the time, but it's a serious form of psychological abuse called gaslighting, which is not the same as lying, which is another part of this pattern. But gaslighting basically means that somebody will get into another person's head deep enough and intentionally enough that it will make this target or this victim distrust their own perception of reality. So pretty much turning the person into a mentally incompetent individual. And there are more like subtle things, but still dangerous when you combine them all together. Competition, when we see organizations that are highly competitive in a dysfunctional way, not necessarily because we're driving towards the same goal, but because the environment itself is cutthroat and you have to cover your back day in and day out. Sabotaging, exploitation. One of the things that we need to remember is that in these dynamics that you have the perpetrator and you have the victim, the perpetrator typically lacks empathy. That's another signature mark of this dynamic. The lack of empathy and the objectification of people for these manipulators to achieve their means at all cost. So that is another form of abuse when you understand at a clinical level that pretty much uses a victim to take advantage of them for meeting those ends in spite of what the victims or the target person is feeling or having to go through in order to benefit this person or group of people manipulating them into acting a certain way. Pathological lying is another part of the abuse cycle that we need to pay attention to, especially when it is a persistent deception to avoid responsibility. When you have somebody that will never take accountability for their actions, it's when it turns into that side of the spectrum, it's abusive in nature. And there are many more, withholding, whether it is withholding information, withholding benefits, withholding access, stonewalling type of behaviors when you're trying to communicate with somebody and you pretty much get nothing out of those people, all the way to financial abuse and the worst case, obviously, that when it becomes big T, like you said, when it turns into violence and things like that, which you typically don't see in the workplace. But the combination of all these different subtle forms of manipulations is what fall in the bucket of narcissistic abuse, and where when the organization and or the leaders or the individuals perpetrating the abuse into employees take and use the combination of these tactics on people is when it becomes dangerous and it becomes concerning.
So what is and I don't know if your research got into this, but what is the prevalence of this in the workplace? What is there's varying estimates of, I think, upwards of 18 to 20% of CEOs may be narcissists. I don't know what that looks like if you extend it to the other C-suite or vice president leaders within organizations. And how often... So what's the prevalence of narcissistic leaders like in general? And how often does it play out that you actually end up with many in the same workplace?
My study did not get deep into that. However, there are statistics that could make us pretty much make assumptions as to how prevalent it is, because it is very prevalent in society in itself. And there are patterns, right, that we bring into the organization because we are a subset of society. So some of the statistics, which are still the statistics at a national level, vary depending on who the source of providing the numbers are and how connected they are with specifically psychological diagnosis of the disorder itself. But the National Institute of Health at some point revealed or posted that at least 6.2% of the population had been clinically diagnosed with what is called narcissistic personality disorder or NPD, only in the US. The problem with this data is that people with narcissistic personality disorder don't necessarily pursue treatment. They don't pursue diagnosis, right? So it is easy to assume that the percentage of people with this type of pathology are out there amongst us every day. So what they say is that there's not a specific available statistic to add up to individuals who go undiagnosed, especially when it comes to what are the implications of this personality disorder when you're appointing people to positions of power. And we are also not using mental health frameworks within organizations incorporated in the succession planning of people with leadership potential. And it's really easy to draw the parallel with if you have a 6.2% of the population dealing with this issue, that should translate closer to what we would find in an organization, especially when we are promoting people that somewhat fall into the categories of what a DSM-5 would consider to bring somebody into diagnosis with narcissistic personality disorder. These are people that are very charismatic, which is something we look up in leaders naturally, very self-absorbed, competitive, those values that we sometimes could see in an organization a little bit exacerbated with no context as to what is healthy and what is not healthy. Sometimes the idea of empathy could be blurry because one signature of these type of leaders or these type of individuals that have this condition or these traits is an inherent lack of empathy that sometimes we can use in an organization as a leadership development opportunity as opposed to really understanding that somebody that lacks empathy genuinely is not a healthy person. Is not the normal for humans is to feel empathy for each other. Another piece to consider here would be a sense of entitlement. These are leaders in organizations that pretty much feel that they deserve where they are. And like I mentioned earlier, it doesn't matter how they got there. They just go through the motions of the professional life in a very self-entitled way, which is another condition that from a psychological standpoint gets measured when you're trying to identify people with this personality trait. And willingness to exploit other people, which kind of ties to the lack of empathy. And if we were to think about the current layoffs that are rampant and how we are not necessarily taking into account the impact of leadership on the people that we lead and try to build some more healthy frameworks to define what good leadership looks like, we are very easily introducing people with this condition into these roles because that's what they do best. They position themselves and they cozy up enough to navigate the politics in a little bit easier way than other people would.
And I think it's important to say that acting as though you have empathy is not the same thing as actually having it. Mm-hmm. And I would suggest that probably many of those that would maybe qualify for that, for the narcissistic personality disorder, may be able to fake it or may try to fake mm-hmm. it in many cases and do so successfully. So it's not necessarily if somebody shows or indicates that they care about other people, that's really truly in their heart. That's really truly, we would say, is that the neural networks in their heart brain are actually lighting up and informing their brain. It may be more of a strategic decision to demonstrate that or to indicate that. Is that fair?
I 100% agree with you. If we want to take it a step further, these individuals are being asked to fake empathy. These individuals are being asked to provide a quote-unquote psychologically safe environment for their people. And they are chameleons. They know how to adapt to what is required of them to hold on to their power. And so that is where the subtlety aspect of this issue comes in, because unless you have, you as a recipient of the dynamic, unless you have either a prior experience where you have gone through this before and you have developed your coping mechanisms and your techniques to deal with it or walk away from it, or you have certain language or certain education that you have pursued that helps you determine, wait a minute, this is a weird behavior, right? And if your intuition is not cleared enough to sense that something's wrong, that can give you the first step into digging into what is happening, you can fall in the trap and be in a psychologically safe meeting with this type of people, exposing yourself and your vulnerabilities, which in my view and some of the things that the victims share with me puts them in a very complicated position to get out of.
So what do you recommend, or what were maybe your ultimate findings from your research, from understanding these traits, how they impact people in the workplace, how they impact workplaces? What was the conclusion or the results of the work that you did here?
Yeah. The first thing I want to say is my research took a look at the phenomenon, like I mentioned at the beginning. Even though you have to understand at the individual level and have some background, especially on the pathology of it, what I wanted to do was to run it through a more specific way to look at an organization and say, okay, we have a framework that we can use to determine the dysfunction, to look into how it is propagated, and to understand what could be some things we could do about to turn it around or to at least address it effectively. So I used a model of organizations that is not new and is not mine. It was invented in the 1970s in France. And it's called, for its initials, SEAM, S-E-A-M, Socioeconomic Approach Management. This framework is specifically intended to uncover dysfunctions within an organization. And I want to share this as a context so that when we get to the findings, you know how I got to compartmentalize some of the data using this perspective. Basically, what this model helps us do is to use the metaphor of a virus, right? Something that's invisible, that is contaminating the organization, that has an ideological nature, that pretty much affects decision-making in an analysis in an organization at a foundational level. So anything that an organization has to assess strategically or tactically requires decision-making, which gets affected by how healthy or not, or dysfunctional or not the organization is. It also addresses what causes, let's say, the virus or the dysfunction in an organization through their structure and the behaviors that we see coming out of leaders and employees. And lastly, it uses the tactical interventions that an organization has, such as training, management practices, anything that we do routinely to maintain right the day-to-day of the business as a infrastructure for propagating how these dysfunctions go rampant in organizations. So in the case of my particular study, the dysfunction that I chose is narcissistic abuse. And that is where the framework gives us some evidences that we can think through as part of the findings. So one of the things that I can share in terms of the systemic view of this issue based on the feedback I received. Oh, there's one more thing with this framework. What makes it unique is that the way in which this framework is operationalized is with the feedback that we collect from employees. So it doesn't go top down, it goes grassroots. So mm-hmm. it collects feedback from employees, and then that feedback turns into data, and then this framework gets enacted. So the same thing I try to do with my study, where I collected feedback from those victims. And some of the things that I walked away with is the objective of institutionalized narcissistic abuse in an organization is to maintain power, to maintain control, to maintain status and be able to cover up mistakes and unethical practices that can then continue to amplify the illusionary view of success that an organization could have to the outsiders, to the people that are not necessarily embedded in at the center of what is really happening in the organization. Just like it happens in a family, just like it happens in a marriage, right? The view of the outside is that everything's perfect, everything's fine. But the people who are in the middle of it, no, it's not. The other piece that I can highlight is through the feedback that victims shared with me and the stories that they shared with me. And another piece for context, and I feel like I'm jumping on and out, but it's important. The victims that provided feedback to my study, for the most part, were high-level leaders. I have people coming from the C-suite. I have people in VP-level jobs. I have people in high-visibility areas of an organization. So I'm just saying this because this type of abuse does not discriminate. It doesn't only happen to people that are powerless. It could affect people that we might perceive on a regular basis as having all the power in the world, and they're pretty much entrenched in this dynamics in secrecy. So their stories revealed when I looked at them all across is that most of the narcissistic abuse in the organization begins at the top with superiors who abuse power. And I don't think this is a surprise finding, but it was my ability to validate, right, the things that we hear every day and put it in the context of how does this type of abuse goes unnoticed, and what does it mean for employees then that are powerless, and what kind of mechanisms then do they have to address it, given that it weakens the organizational layers by the time it gets to a regular employee that has zero power.
Unfortunately, it almost seems from given the research in the space, and there's varying levels, I think, when it comes to narcissistic diagnoses or understanding the characteristic or the traits of a narcissist, I think that there is somewhat of a spectrum there as well. Mm-hmm. There are those that exhibit all of those traits, and it's mm-hmm. very prevalent mm-hmm. and it's very harmful. And part of, I think, the reason we see so many leaders exhibiting those traits is because those that are able to manipulate themselves to get to the result that they want, to achieve the power that they want, are going to get it. They're going to figure out what they need to say, to do, how they need to be, how they need to present. They're not going to make your typical mistakes. They're not going to have your typical breakdowns or your vulnerability. They're going to withstand criticism and negative feedback and the things that might actually cause difficulty for those of us that maybe aren't in that same bucket, that aren't in that hyperinflated view of oneself type of personality. Mm-hmm. And so you end up with, the odds are, I think everybody who's been in leadership has encountered a leader who is a narcissist. And probably most organizations, whether statistically we know it or not, have at least one somewhere mm-hmm. in that mix. I think it's helpful to see, certainly if it starts at the very top, how that can systemically trickle throughout and create that negative behavior or that traumatic and toxic environment for everybody within it. And unfortunately, I don't think I think you're right that even at the top layers of the organization, there's not much you can do, especially if it's a CEO, if it's the person who's in charge. There's really not a mechanism for holding that person accountable. And so is there any answer in this space? What do you think the answer is for people who find themselves in these situations or who are part of working for someone that they are receiving this type of narcissistic abuse? And maybe they're not even comfortable admitting it's abuse yet, but they can identify that they're having that experience. What are their options?
This is a topic that we could talk about for a long time. So I'm going to try to provide two or three pieces that are important, I think, from the research. The first thing is, in all of my participants communicated this in one way or another, but nobody teaches you this stuff, okay? So if you are in a situation like this and you're picking on behaviors that seem manipulative, that seem that are making you act out of character, that seem that are making you people please too much, or where you feel like you're integrity is compromised at any level, it's important that we start self-educating. Or if we have somebody to go to that can help us provide perspective, immediately try to seek a broader perspective that could help you come into these dynamics in an informed way, so that the language, the tactics people can bring into the situation, which can vary depending on whether you're dealing with a CEO or you're dealing with a manager or you're dealing with a peer, that you're able to equip yourself going forward as to what to do for your own self-preservation. That's what becomes the most important. I think that some of the things to educate ourselves around include the topic itself, narcissism, narcissistic abuse, the tactics of navigating narcissistic abuse. There's a ton of stuff out there that you can Google. That's how I started in my journey, actually. I had the instinct 15 years ago that something was off, and I started Googling certain behaviors, and that kind of brought me to, okay, there's a thing, there's a playbook, there is a framework to go through. But the education part of it, it's extremely important because you're not going to receive it naturally. And there's a lot of things going mainstream that are actually damaging the understanding of how critical and how pervasive this is, that we need to start demystifying and stopping really the stigma of it. The other thing is, it's important for people to understand that even though an organization has the best intentions to address the dysfunction and they're trying to figure out the best practices to support employees, those parts of the institution like HR and ethics and compliance and all those organisms that are supposed to hold the organization accountable are also learning about this stuff. This is not something that gets talked about often. And even when we put it in the context of bullying or work or toxic workplaces, the topics are still being researched and the topics are still being figured out as to what that means from a policy standpoint to have mechanisms to address the issue. And so sometimes it could be that going the route of the institutional response may not be the best route for an individual, especially if you are in a situation where your personal integrity, your relationship with your leader, and the response that you're receiving, the support that you're receiving around you continues to isolate you, it may be better to find support externally through either therapy or practitioners that understand employment law or other thought leaders that you may come across that talk about these things, so that you can have an outsider perspective that can help you work together with your organization where it makes sense to put you in a position that is a little bit less risky for your particular employment and your situation there. And from a leadership standpoint, I really think that we need to start to become more critical of who do we look up to and what this leadership means for us as individuals. Simon Sinek has this amazing quote that means everything to me. He says, we have to be the leaders we wish we had. And that begins with our self-leadership. We have to work really hard to identify for ourselves, what is the model of leadership that we are going to look up to? Who are the kinds of leaders that we are going to follow? We have to take responsibility for that individually so that we slow down our circumstances where we could fall prey of leaders who are not necessarily healthy to lead people. But it needs a deeper level of self-awareness as to what do we look in a leader? What does leadership mean to us? What kind of leader do we want to become? And who do we respect? Who are people that we actually look and say, I respect this person because it has this and this and these qualities. And I feel like that's a constant work we need to do so that we start weeding out the people that we might get entrenched with in the workplace. I'm not able to hear you, Jessica.
Sorry.
You're good.
I think all of that is so helpful and so valuable. I love all of those thoughts and those suggestions. And it makes me think, too, that when it comes to encountering this, most people are going to encounter it. And I love that you suggest first understanding it, learning about it, making sense of it. The other thing I think that's important to note is that from a neuroscience perspective, that the brains of people with narcissistic personality disorder are different, that there is a different makeup that creates that result. And there's still, I would say, somewhat limited research in terms of there's a genetic component. There's also potentially a trauma or upbringing component that comes into play there. But I want to bring some level of encouragement in that we know that the brain can rewire itself. We know that the brain can change itself, that we can create new neural pathways. And so I think what's most important is that those that are early in their career, to your point about leadership and Simon Sinek's quote about be the leader that you needed or that you wish you had, is to be thinking about what are the traits or what is the development and skills development that you want to make sure you put into place now so that as you do rise in terms of leadership, as you do get more power, more authority, more opportunity to affect more lives, you're really grounded in that empathy. You're grounded in the best leadership skill sets that you can have. And for me, I think that comes back to a lot of self-awareness. It comes back to leaders doing the work earlier in their career and getting into a practice of self-awareness, of mindfulness, of understanding their motivations and their intentions, of understanding the experiences of other people. Because if you do that, you'll create the brain connections, the brain patterns mm-hmm. to wire that into your way of being. And I think mm-hmm. what we see in narcissists, to your point and everything you've shared with us, is that they've created ways of being, patterns in their brains and in their neurophysiology that lend itself to their own self-interest, that lend it to them maintaining power and control, them being in a place where they feel secure, because often they are also very insecure. They are also have a very delicate sense of self. That is why they create this grandiose image and they have to have this power and this control. Mm-hmm. And so in a lot of ways, I think the biggest red flag for a narcissist is someone who's unwilling to do any of their own self-work. So if somebody's gotten to a CEO position and they now think they don't need training, they don't need coaching, they don't need any further development, they're the king on high, that should be a red flag for boards and those that have maybe oversight over it. And so really watching that as people climb the ranks, are they still as invested in their own development? Are they still self-aware? Are they willing to change themselves as we make decisions about who to promote, I think is a really important factor to be considering. And I think that there's probably some work that we can do as leaders to work on those pathways, to make some shifts and changes, to stay connected in those ways.
There are a couple of things you're making me think about that are important too. Absolutely. How we move forward, framing who gets to be a potential for leader and how do we help develop this person into leadership roles is fundamental, and it needs to change. It's outdated. It does not align with where the world is going, with where humanity is going. We're asking people who are incapable of bringing that type of humanity into the organization to fake it, and it's creating more damage. And the piece that's important for people to recognize is that when you come across these individuals or people that may suggest having this type of, again, dark, manipulative, insensitive type of leadership style, is that the percentage of them who have capacity for change is really small. And this is something that psychologists and psychiatrists have agreed upon in their own research. This is not me talking. But when you get to read different takes on the situation, that they all come into agreement that it's not worth losing yourself to these type of relationships. If you are a healthy person, or if you are somebody who's dealing with some early trauma and are bringing this into the workplace, but you yourself are somebody who's naturally empathetic, somebody who wants to do good for the world, somebody who wants to help other people, somebody that has integrity and work ethics, it's better that you focus on developing those strengths than in trying to change those individuals that will not change. Is that coming across coherently?
Yes.
Because we spend a lot of time, and I say this from a personal standpoint, and you may have similar experiences, Jessica, but when you are early in being entrenched in these relationships, you have certain hope that you are going to be able to change that person, or that you're going to be able to do something to please them where they changed, right? Their care for you. Is not going to happen. It's part of their mental playbook to get people in their orbit and then get them out of it because you're a threat. So, or because they need you there to satisfy their need for attention. And the moment you remove that attention, then it becomes a toxic situation. So you come first and your humanity comes first. Even if you recognize that the people that you're looking up to are not able to value that in you, it does not matter. That's on them.
Yeah. And I just always like to bring the hope for folks to say that as much as we know about these experiences and these challenges, there's ways to improve yourself despite them. I talked about that we've both been in situations where we've been, I hate to use the word victim, but where we've been victimized by narcissistic behavior. And those relationships, be it romantic relationships or be it workplace relationships, wherever those relationships are, they're going to leave an impact just because we've had them, just because we've had that experience. And because we know that our neurophysiology is so malleable, it's plastic, we can rewire ourselves, we can change ourselves, we can heal through the things that we've experienced. The most valuable thing people can do is to dive it right into that, to understand what those experiences were, how they've impacted them, and then choose which elements of those will serve them for the future. And which won't, which patterns will help protect them and which ones they don't want to have because it's going to hurt them more. And I think that if there's anything I would want to, as we come to the end to wrap this up, to focus on is the hope that if we pay attention to the right things, if we embed the right ways of development, and like you said, better reasons are modes for making leadership promotion decisions for who gets into those positions and those roles, and provide people with the support to have that self-awareness, there's hope for a better outcome, but certainly not doing things the way that we've always done them. That is not going to create a different result. Lindsay, do you have any final thoughts, opinions, comments as we bring this episode to a close?
Yeah, there are so many things that people really need to get in front of as far as educating themselves. But one thing that I always tell people I talk to is First of all, narcissism is not leadership. We need to start understanding and putting them in the categories that they belong and start comparing very critically. Where is this playing out and where are we looking up to? If anybody that's listening is considering this information and maybe identifying situations you're embedded into, and this is a typical experience where you feel like you're crazy and you're the one making stuff up, stop right there. Listen to your intuition. You're not crazy. And it's important that we put ourselves in situations where we can get validated in our experience, that we can be seen and heard and advocated for. That should be the highest purpose of any leader. But as we discussed, it may not be within your immediate orbit of people that you're working with that you will find that. But it's important that you get out of your own way and find people that validates you for the experience that you're having. The courage to bring up these kinds of issues is uncharted at this point. And it takes a lot of guts to come forward with sharing these type of experiences with each other and talking about them openly and seriously. But it's definitely a force multiplier, having conversations like the one we're having here, Jessica, to start dismantling the confusion that exists and the trivializing that exists today, especially in the context of the workplace, and that we start to create more meaningful infrastructures that can provide real safety and real morals and ethics in organizations. I think we need to bring that back in style and raise the bar a little bit there.
Certainly, I'm not sure that it's back in style. I'm not sure that ethical and moral behavior has ever really made its way there. So I would say we need to do a better job, that we know better. We know enough now to know how unethical, immoral, unprofessional, disrespectful, I'll take it to that level, because sometimes it's not even illegal. It's just disrespectful. How we get the right behaviors in place and how we develop leaders so that we don't end up with this narcissistic, self-serving behavior at the top of our organizations and driving the results, purpose, and outcomes for our workplaces. Because then if it is a narcissist in that role, it is always going to be driven out of self-interest. And that means it's not going to take into consideration the greater good of the people, of the world, of the impact, of all of the things. And that's how we end up with situations like Enron. That's how we end up with situations where we have these narcissists in power and in control of significant aspects of our lives and of our experiences. So for those that are in these experiences, I just want to say that my heart goes out to you. Many of us have been there. We've been in the situation and in the seat that you're in. I just want to validate that experience and open the door to say that you're not alone. Reach out, talk to someone else who's been in this situation. Reach out to Lindsay. She's an expert. Reach out to me and look for ways that you can develop yourself so that you can heal from the experiences that you're having. So as always, I want to remind our listeners to just always keep evolving, keep growing, keep looking for those opportunities to rewire your neural pathways so that you can have more exceptional experiences on your life journey. I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day, and we'll be back again next week with another episode.